On the Media is a listener-supported podcast. You like it, maybe even really like it. And to be honest, WNYC pays for most of it. So as the year draws to a close, consider this. If you donate by December 31st, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar by the Tao Foundation. We've never had that kind of offer before, so give a little and we'll get twice as much. Just text OTM to 69866, a simple form will pop up and you can send a little something in a matter of seconds. Or go to onthemedia.org/support online and make your contribution there. You'll be our angel investor. No, you'll be a golden god.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. You may have heard about the latest thing that will kill you.
Welcome back. A new study from the University of Sydney. Hey, you going, mate? Finds that sleeping more than 9 hours a day is associated with a higher risk of premature death.
Coming up, a new study about sleep and whether too much of a good thing is actually a bad thing.
The Daily Mail wrote, too much sleep is as bad for your health as smoking and drinking alcohol. And Cosmopolitan wrote, oh great, oversleeping can kill you. Extra sleep, that one thing we all thought was sacred, unequivocally good for us, is deadly?
Well, as you might expect if you're a regular listener, this study isn't as scary as it sounds. It pointed to statistical associations, not cause and effect. The researchers hedged their findings, conceding that the sample wasn't representative, and they even caution against definitive statements about the results. But that's all in the actual study, and no one, reporters or news consumers, wants to read that, right?
Sleep's momentary fall from grace is just the latest link in a perpetual feedback loop of specious health stories proclaiming that a favored health behavior, like drinking red wine, for instance, will either kill you...
Wine or any alcohol increases the risk of breast cancer.
...or save you.
Ladies, drink your red wine. It could prevent breast cancer.
...or kill you.
I probably told you hundreds of times that red wine is good for your heart. But recent news is raising questions.
Or save you.
It'll help you with good cholesterol.
Right.
It lowers blood pressure, lowers stress, and just has many, many health benefits.
And so for the rest of the show, we'll revisit our favorite segments about the dodgy world of health news, celebrity diet advice, and the marketing of maladies, complete with two of our Breaking News Consumers Handbooks, which you can find on our website. Let's start with an object lesson.
John Bohannon is a contributing correspondent at Science Magazine. Back in December of 2014, he received a call from German TV reporter Peter Onekin, who had an intriguing proposition.
Let's do a real study with real people to test the health benefits of chocolate. We're going to do a really bad job on the statistics and the design of the experiment. Get a bad paper published and then build a global multimedia campaign around it and see how far it goes. In Germany, it's as big a problem as it is here. There are diet fads that come like tsunamis every few months. You wonder, how did journalists miss this? Why didn't they smell a rat when they started looking into the story in the first place?
And so the study was launched. Onekin and his partner Diana Lovell used Facebook to recruit 5 men and 11 women aged 19 to 67. A German doctor named Gunther Frank oversaw the 3-week trial. That's right, 16 people, 3 weeks.
People were randomly assigned to 3 groups. One was the control. So basically for a few weeks, it's going to be life as usual. Another group was on a low-carb diet. Nothing drastic, kind of a standard low-carbohydrate diet. And then the third group was the exact same low-carbohydrate diet plus a bar of chocolate every day.
An ounce and a half of bitter chocolate, like over 80% cocoa.
That was Günter Frank's idea. He says that in Germany, there's this almost religious movement for foods that taste bad, therefore they must be good for you. You have to make it slightly unpleasant.
If they could discern any difference at all between the low-carb chocolate eaters and the others, they would declare that chocolate worked.
Now, here's the trick. If you want to get a false positive effect, something that looks sexy but probably isn't real, measure a ton of stuff about those people.
So they recorded 18 different measurements: blood protein levels, cholesterol, sodium, sleep quality, well-being, everything. Except for one seemingly crucial marker for a diet experiment: what they ate.
Oh, well, if you want to be a stickler, we actually didn't care, really, what they ate. Because our goal wasn't to do good science. We wanted to create a big multidimensional data set that we could go treasure hunting in.
And the results?
If you eat chocolate, you lost a pound or two, 10% faster than the group that didn't eat chocolate.
Less than the amount a woman could possibly lose in the course of a month with her menstrual cycle.
You got it. That could just be water weight.
Now the easy part, publishing the result. As we've covered before on the show, the pay-to-publish science journal industry is notoriously easy to buy into.
I just tried to do my shopping on the list of known bad guys. And sure enough, I started getting acceptances within 24 hours.
2 weeks later, for the bargain price of 600 euros, they were in print. The final touch, Bohannon's hot and sticky press release.
It really should be kind of a perfect little story. It should tell you why you should care, what happened, be very specific, and then provide a lot of what we call color. Quotes and funny connections if they exist. Something I didn't do. This was coming out pretty close to Easter, and it's a study about chocolate. I should have made that connection. Luckily, all of the journalists who covered this had the same idea.
And you had made up quotes, one by a certain Mr. Johannes Bohannon.
Oh, please, doctor. Dr. Johannes Bohannon. Herr Dr. Bohannon said, "The best part about this discovery is that you can buy chocolate everywhere."
What makes my skin crawl is when I hold the news release in one hand and the story in the other hand, and the quote is lifted verbatim from the news release without attribution.
Gary Schweitzer, the publisher of healthnewsreview.org, is a dogged exposer of health news shams, scams, and all-round slop.
It makes the news organization look like it independently sought out that work. The reporter really never left his or her desk. You're not living up to your responsibility as a journalist if you do that.
And so, the first item in our Breaking News Consumer's Handbook Health News Edition, watch out for single-source stories. They're usually based on press releases. Item number two, beware stories that don't mention cost.
Reuters had a story about an immunotherapy combination promising in a melanoma study. The drug in question costs around $30,000 per injection, and the combined cost, more than $250,000 a year. The story didn't touch on cost at all. How can we be talking about how wonderful a drug is and not talk about costs?
Something else to consider: when a new treatment is said to reduce your risk of disease by, say, 50%, is it a relative 50% or an actual 50%? Stay with me.
It's the omega-3s in fish, like salmon, will reduce your risk for depression up to 50%.
Oh, wow.
Ask yourself, 50% of what? Here's a classic example. When a drug company marketed its drug for osteoporosis.
This was a Merck drug, right?
Yep. They marketed it as reducing the rate of hip fracture by 50%. The data showed it reduced the risk of hip fracture from 2 in 100 in the untreated group to 1 in 100 in the treated group. That is indeed a 50% relative risk reduction, but in the absolute look at how the group benefited, 1 in 100 benefited. It is a 1% absolute risk reduction, and the other 99 had to run the risk of side effects and pay for the drug and stand no chance of benefit.
Item four, if you think it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
If all you hear is predominantly about the benefits, run for the hills, because there are trade-offs in all healthcare interventions.
One way you'll know you're not getting the full picture, the fifth item on our list: beware too many patient testimonials.
You know, there's this old saying, the plural of anecdote is not data. We write a lot about screening tests. Patients saying, "I'm glad I had that mammogram. I'm glad I had that PSA blood test for prostate cancer because it saved my life." Something that we can never prove.
Which brings us to item 6.
Now, for the first time, there's evidence that a simple screening test can catch lung tumors earlier.
If you ever hear somebody talking about a simple screening test, there is no such thing. Screening test decisions should be among the most complex that we face in all of our healthcare decision making. Some people will say, it's not a screening test decision. It's a decision about what you do after the results of the screening test. To those people, I'd say you have not talked with people who have experienced harms and regrets, as I have and as many people have.
And there are other words you should watch for, words like...
A breakthrough in treating heart disease.
There's a breakthrough in treating blindness.
It's called a medical miracle treatment saving lives.
The miracle treatment some are calling hope in a petri dish.
Plus a treatment that's the first of its kind.
It has approved a first of its kind treatment.
A game changer in the way breast cancer is treated.
A new treatment could be a game changer.
First of all, this isn't a game. Let's stop calling it a game changer. Is this making a difference in people's lives, or is it making a difference in people's pocketbooks first, before all the evidence is in hand? We hear this could become the new standard of care. Anytime you hear it may become, it could become, substitute it may not become.
Item 8, new isn't always better.
There's a phrase in medicine right now that I think we ought to adopt in journalism, and it's called slow medicine. And it's clinicians talking to each other saying, this is getting out of control. Let's slow down. Let's talk with patients. Let's make sure we do a good history before we pull out that prescription pad.
Related to this slow medicine movement, the 9th item in our handbook, beware of disease mongering. That means turning normal conditions like balding into pathologies. And
disease mongering can also apply to treating risk factors for disease as if they were diseases unto themselves. So maybe the classic example is LDL cholesterol. Do we make the public fixate on know your numbers without dwelling on the numbers that really matter, like did this have an impact on the rate of death from heart disease? In disease mongering, we lower the threshold. So we now get more bent out of shape about blood pressures, blood cholesterol levels, blood glucose levels that are lower than what we used to get bent out of shape about 10 or 15 years ago.
Item 10. Treatment availability is often a mirage.
The test is still in preclinical trial phases.
The company is hoping for FDA approval by the end of the year.
Take the crystal ball and throw it out the window. Phase one drug trials, they're meant primarily to say, hey, before we go forward, let's make sure it's safe. But you'll see stories about phase one trials that make claims about benefits. As if these things were available at our corner drugstore, and they're not.
And finally, item 11, the distance between mice and men.
Researchers studying mice found that exposure to cell phone radiation during pregnancy affected brain development.
If a study on mice is any indication, the idea of yo-yo dieting may actually be good for you after all.
The leap from mice to men and women. Well, this month we had these great pictures of Pluto. It's about that much of a leap.
Thus concludes our Breaking News Consumer's Handbook Health News Edition. Now let's check back with John Bohannon. When we last left our hero, he had successfully completed a 3-week-long sham trial designed to illustrate the weight loss potential of dark chocolate. Armed with an article printed in a pay-to-publish medical journal and a killer press release, it was time to see what news outlets would take the bait.
The largest tabloid newspaper in Europe, called Bild, published out of Germany, did a cover story on it. You know, that reached a huge number of people immediately. And then it spread to the British tabloid newspapers, the Daily Star, the Irish Examiner, the Times of India, Cosmopolitan's German website, and then it spread to television.
German scientists found out your diet works better, faster, if you combine it with dark chocolate.
This is real. Adding chocolate, you'll lose weight. I'm not kidding.
A study out of Germany found that chocolate not only accelerates weight loss, but also aids in sleep quality.
To be fair, the study wasn't picked up by the New York Times or the Washington Post. the Daily Mail or Bild. They're not known for their journalistic rigor.
Where do you think the vast majority of people who pick up a fad diet learned it? It's not from the New York Times. They learn it from the Daily Mail and the Huffington Post and the Internet.
John Bohannon is a contributing correspondent at Science Magazine.
Coming up, beware celebs selling snake oil.
Celebrities like Madonna and Demi Moore are said to be big fans of werewolf diet. Okay. Advocates claim that fasting with juice cleanses during a new moon or a full moon can help you lose as much as 6 pounds in a single day.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It's not just fake studies like John Bohannon's chocolate study we just heard about that trickle up through the tabloid press. Countless life enhancers and beautifiers are fixtures in glossy magazines, each one backed by experts who stand as living proof of their efficacy. Those radiant celebrities.
You know, these are not evil people. There's not a star chamber with Gwyneth and Oprah where they're making decisions about what we're supposed to eat.
Timothy Caulfield is the author of Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? How the Famous Sell Us Elixirs of Health, Beauty, and Happiness.
Actresses and actors, sports figures, musicians, they're under more pressure than any of us to look good, to stay thin, to never age. So they're looking for solutions to that problem. And often they're just talking about it in social media and in the popular press.
While Caulfield urges us to have compassion for celebrities, he nevertheless finds fault with the fad diets and bogus beauty treatments they endorse. So now, our second Breaking News Consumer's Handbook, Celebrity Edition. First up, beware the BIEB, or BIEB.
Beauty Industry Efficacy Bias. Consumers want it to work. The healthcare providers want it to work. Obviously, the industry wants it to be portrayed as if it works. And magazines aren't going to sell magazines telling people that none of this stuff works. So all the social forces kind of point in the direction of making people think this stuff is effective.
The BIEB, he says, affects us in two ways. First, fad diets.
So celebrities like Madonna and Demi Moore are said to be big fans of the werewolf diet. Advocates claim that fasting with juice cleanses during a new moon or a full moon can help you lose as much as 6 pounds in a single day.
Yes, Jennifer Aniston has made this baby food diet famous. What you do on the baby food diet is you replace your daytime eating with baby food.
Sure, those sound stupid, but how about cleansing, fasting, detoxing?
They're scientifically ludicrous on every level. There's no evidence that we need to detox. We have organs that do that. There's no evidence that the proposed regimen, whatever that is going to help you detox, right? And I hate the messaging behind it, some kind of quick fix, when what you really need to do is find a lifestyle that you can sustain forever.
And don't talk to Caulfield about gluten.
I don't think this trend would exist but for celebrity culture, by the way, without people like Gwyneth and Miley Cyrus and all the sports figures that say that they've benefited from going gluten-free. So is going gluten-free healthier? No. A study just came out that found that gluten-free food is no healthier. In fact, in some cases, it might be less healthy. There may be more sodium and less healthy fats in there. Is it a good weight loss strategy? Again, no evidence to support the idea. Some studies have even suggested that people put on weight when they go gluten-free long-term. Short-term, people probably lose weight because, again, they're concentrating what they're eating. Then we come to the really controversial thing. Non-celiac gluten sensitivity.
By which you mean if you don't have a diagnosed case of celiac disease, the belief is you could still be sensitive to gluten and it could still cause everything from fatigue to migraines.
There is an ongoing debate in the academic literature about whether this phenomenon exists. The best studies where they've done actual clinical trials have found no gluten sensitivity, right? So 1% of the population is celiac and there may be an additional 1% to 6% at the outside of it may have some form of non-celiac gluten sensitivity. There's no way it could account for the growth in the popularity of going gluten-free.
The BIEB reigns supreme in the beautification industry. Consider Kim Kardashian's vampire facial, whereby a substance distilled from your own blood is injected back into your face. Or the sheep placenta facial, allegedly favored by Victoria Beckham. Or drinking 8 glasses of water a day. I can't believe I just said that.
Yeah, that's one of the most persistent myths I came across. You know, it's just not true. And people just swear by it. Look, you drink when you're thirsty, full stop. And there's no evidence that drinking all this water, like Jennifer Aniston says we should, is going to make your skin glow and rejuvenate and blah, blah, blah.
Speaking of glow and rejuvenate, they're on a list of watchwords Caulfield has assembled to indicate a science-free zone. Also on that list, clinically proven.
Does that mean that they did a study, they asked two of their patients, and the patients thought that they looked better? What kind of clinical study was it? Dermatology approved. What does that mean? That doesn't necessarily mean that there's any scientific evidence to support it. If there was an anti-aging product out there, I swear to God, we'd know it worked because the data would be everywhere.
And if you see the word toxin.
Toxins have kind of become the modern day evil spirits residing in our cells and making us fat and making us tired and depressed. There's just no evidence to support that idea. And again, no evidence that any of the products and processes that are being marketed by celebrity culture are going to rid your body of toxins. You know what really works? You know what the anti-aging things are? Don't smoke. Stay out of the sun. Get exercise. Exercise seems to actually have a physiological impact on your skin. Eat well. You know, the dream crusher, right?
And get sleep.
One of the things I was most surprised about is the evidence around sleep.
He's a right buzzkill, he is. Why do we continue in denial, in magical thinking? Because we want to escape death. And in the case of chocolate, because we like it.
So many people contacted me in the wake of this saying, you know, I'm so disappointed.
John Bohannon.
Even reporters would guiltily mention this when they were interviewing me about the whole stunt. They would say, you know, part of me just hoped beyond hope that chocolate really could maybe help me in some way.
You know, I had that experience myself.
Look, it might actually be the case that chocolate helps. You can't draw the opposite conclusion. You really can't draw any conclusion from this study. It's like reading tea leaves, and that was the point. If you do really bad science, you can make up any story you want. So if you're eating chocolate and it seems to be helping you, stick with it.
Get your chocolate out and let's lose some weight.
On our website, you can also find our second Breaking News Consumer's Handbook related to health news, The Celebrity Edition, as well as our Spot the Tomfoolery Quiz, where you can find out how adept you are at distinguishing real bogus health stories from fake bogus health stories.
Who, you might ask, but probably haven't, petitioned to get the yoga mat out of your Subway sandwich and the synthetic coal tar out of your kid's mac and cheese? Ah, that would be the food babe. That's what self-styled food investigator Vani Hari does. She's built up a huge internet following by scouring food labels for frightening chemicals and unleashing her followers on the offending companies. Thus, Hari told us, McDonald's, Kraft, General Mills, and Panera Bread, among others, have pledged to remove one chemical or another from their foods. Here's Hari on Fox News during Halloween season, which is to say, pumpkin spice latte season.
One of the things I found out about the pumpkin spice latte is it has two doses of caramel coloring level 4. And caramel coloring level 4, according to the National Toxicity Program and the International Agency for Research on Cancer, has said that these ingredients are linked to cancer.
Never mind that there's no reason to believe that the coloring agent is dangerous to humans in the concentration used in food. Starbucks has vowed to look into phasing it out, but it won't get rid of acrylamide, a chemical on the same cancer-causing chemical list. That's because it's in coffee. Of course, everything we eat and drink is composed entirely of chemicals, including dihydrogen monoxide, otherwise known as water. That's why the food babe has been savaged by journalists and scientists. Her campaign against chemicals seems to be indiscriminate and based on flimsy science. One writer called her the Jenny McCarthy of food. Among her critics is Michelle Francel, a professor of chemistry at Bryn Mawr College and blogger at The Culture of Chemistry and Slate. When we spoke earlier this year, she explained why that yoga mat chemical, azodicarbonamide, would be in our bread in the first place.
In your bread, it's not hazardous to you. It helps to stabilize the foam. Bread is just essentially a foam. The trouble with that chemical is it's a huge respiratory irritant, So, for example, it's banned in the EU, not because it's so hazardous to eat. In fact, when you eat it, it looks a lot like a protein, and so your body knows how to take that molecule apart and turn it into something it can use. But for the workers who work with it, it's a real hazard. And so ethically, it's not a great idea to be eating bread that has that in it, because there are all these workers exposed to this very potent respiratory irritant.
Michelle, please tell me about beaver anus and why I should not be afraid of it.
You're talking about castoreum, found in sacks near the beaver's butt. And it's been used for 2,000 years. It turns out to taste a little bit like vanilla, and it's got a pretty pungent smell to it. The FDA recognizes it as safe. You shouldn't be afraid of it because it's not really used anywhere. It costs about $640 to buy enough of that to fill up a 4-ounce bottle. So it isn't in your vanilla ice cream, and it's not in your oatmeal. It might be in an expensive perfume or aftershave you use.
However, the Food Babe says it is in those things, and we should all adjust our diets accordingly.
Well, I think she enjoys the fact that beaver butt is incredibly good clickbait. If you look at her Food Babe blog, it's on there about 60 times, and in the book she's written recently, it appears over and over again.
Hari's following, I guess, has to do with a couple of things. Number one is that she's extremely attractive. The other thing is these chemicals just sound scary. There's a term for this, processing fluency.
Right. We trust material that is familiar, words that we can pronounce. Lots of chemical terms come from the Greek, so they have a lot of harsh-sounding vowels and consonant mixes in them, oxidane, methotrexate. They sound scary. But something like Formarvel's powder sounds very safe. You know what a powder is. You know what four is. Marvels, that sounds like something that might be good for you. It's actually a medicine, but it doesn't sound like a medicine, right? It sounds safe and friendly. That's processing fluency.
Four Marvels powder. You plucked this from a story in the New York Times Magazine. Can you tell me about it?
Yep. Her son had juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, which is, you know, incredibly painful. His physician suggested methotrexate, which is an anti-cancer drug. It sounds nasty, and in fact, at high doses is quite nasty. She read all the side effects information, and she talked to a friend of a friend who said, my son uses Four Marvels powder and Montmorency cherry juice, which I said in the article sounds like something a Disney princess might use. The trouble is that Four Marvels powder sounds much friendlier than methotrexate, but in fact includes compounds that, like methotrexate, can damage your liver. And yet she was giving unknown doses of this to her kid on top of something else that was also liver toxic. Part of it was this idea of chemophobia, that we're blind to the chemicals around us. She sees the chemical in the prescribing information, but the Four Marvels powder comes in a little envelope and doesn't have that attached to it, so she doesn't see it.
So the Food Babe and her fellow travelers aren't necessarily citing incorrect facts, but they're depriving us of the context we need to make informed dietary and health decisions. Is there anything that she has offered as advice that you consider particularly irresponsible?
Well, in the Food Babe's book, she talks about you shouldn't drink pasteurized milk because it destroys the phosphatase enzymes involved in calcium uptake. We make our own phosphatase, but drinking unpasteurized milk is dangerous. People die from that.
What is it in us, do you suppose, that makes us want to take medical and dietary advice from some page on the internet while being skeptical of what we're told by nutritionists, organic chemists, physicians, and other trained professionals?
Ben Goldacre, who is a physician and a science writer in Britain, had an interesting take on this. He said we portray science as incomprehensible and the people who do it is kind of wacky and a bit off. You know, think of Sheldon on the Big Bang Theory, right? Part of it is the language that scientists use. And I think the last piece is that we have a distrust of scientists because science has also brought us things that are not so good, right? We have DDT as a pesticide.
Nobel Prize winner Fritz Haber created mustard gas.
And my freshman chemistry teacher, Sherry Rowland, discovered that, you know, we were killing off the ozone layer with the fluorocarbons, which we thought to be inert. So chemistry has not always been benign. And I think that that's another piece that makes it an uphill battle.
We tried to get in touch with Vani Hari, and she declined to join us for an interview. And she has not been particularly hospitable to criticism online. I know that at one point you did try to get the ear of Vani Hari, and you were stymied. Tell me about glutamates.
Okay, yes. Yeah. So she had a post on her blog about monosodium glutamate-free tomato soup. But tomatoes contain free glutamate. That's actually one of the reasons they're used so much in cooking, because it really brings out the flavor. And you put in salt, which contains sodium. So you're making monosodium glutamate in this soup, 400 milligrams a serving. So I put on her site, this soup contains 400 milligrams of glutamate per serving. And the comment disappeared. And I thought, did I forget to click publish? And I tried four times, and every time it disappeared. I think that part of it is that she's having a hard time engaging the science. And so what she does is she turns and she engages the people. And if she can find a spot to pull and poke and say, well, you must be employed by Monsanto, or you must have worked for a company that made chemicals at one time, that immediately destroys any credibility you have. She, of course, is paid by a lot of food companies herself.
And their foods are entirely composed of what?
Chemicals.
Michelle, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Michelle Frantzel is a professor of chemistry at Bryn Mawr College. She blogs at The Culture of Chemistry and Slate. We asked Vani Hari for an interview when we first aired this piece back in April. Instead, her book publicist sent us a statement that says in part, quote, "The attacks on me and this movement is indeed another distraction from the need to reform our food system. But nonetheless, this is a sign we are winning. Many food industry professionals and chemists are threatened by my work because millions of people are realizing they do not want artificial or synthetic additives in their food." Taryn Harper Wright devotes her free time to uncovering online illness hoaxes designed to generate cash donations or just the attention of strangers. This began about 3 years ago while Taryn herself was bedridden after a hip injury, with a lot of free time to browse Facebook. One day, a post about the death of a woman from Saskatchewan named Dana Durr appeared in her newsfeed.
Dana Durr was a Canadian trauma surgeon and the mother of 11 children who was killed in a drunk driving accident on the night before Mother's Day.
Dana Durr was pregnant when this accident occurred, and she gave birth to a child right before she died in the very same hospital where she had saved lives daily for years. As if that weren't heart-wrenching enough,
the family also had a little guy who was, I think, 8 years old. He was just about to pretty much die from cancer when his mother actually was killed in the drunk driving accident. The father was a Canadian Mountie, and they had adopted a bunch of children. This came across my Facebook feed 3 years ago, the most tragic, awful story ever.
And you looked at this story, and you said, oh, my goodness, this is horrible. Wait, what? Your antenna went up.
It did. I did a Google News search right away just to see what these people looked like. Nothing popped up other than Facebook posts and blog posts that the family themselves had made. So that right away kind of tinged my radar, because mother dying on Mother's Day and delivering the baby as she was dying, that would have been something that somebody would have picked up on. Some of the pictures showed up in Google image search, and children who were supposedly the Durr children ended up being the children of a South African blogger.
So something was rotten in Saskatchewan. How long did it take you to figure out who was doing what and how?
It took a good 13 or 14 hours to get to who was behind the hoax. I kept updating my blog as the night went on, and I would get more and more emails from people who had interacted with the Durr family. Pretty soon, I got a return address label from a woman in Ohio named Emily Durr. Turned out that she was the person that was behind the hoax.
What did she have to say to you?
At first, she said that her brother was a Canadian Mountie, that the story did really happen, that the reason that other people's children's pictures were involved was because he had a really top-secret government job and couldn't post pictures of his own family. We were at that point talking over email, and I said to her, you know, I don't believe any of this. Read the blog. We talked on the phone, and she basically confessed the whole thing.
You discovered how many fake Facebook profiles that she had to assemble to keep this Ponzi scheme of sympathy going?
She had 71 or 72 fake Facebook profiles. She also had sent out awareness bracelets, kind of like the yellow Livestrong bracelets that people wear, with Warrior Eli written on them to draw attention to her web pages and descriptions of the family's cancer battle.
Now, people who have seen the documentary called Catfish are probably familiar with this kind of pathology, someone perpetrating extraordinarily intricate frauds, not for any financial benefit, but, as you say, just to get attention. Did she seem especially needy to you when you spoke to her?
She had sort of a flat effect. I don't think she was going through a good time in her life. I don't think I'll ever really know her motivation, but I do think it was something that kind of snowballed out of control for her. She didn't really expect to pick up the following that she did. She didn't expect for people to kind of hang on every word that the family wrote on Facebook and on their blog. And honestly, when we talked on the phone, she told me that she was actually glad that it was over with, that she had been kind of looking for a way out of it.
Now, Emily Durr was your first gotcha, but not your last, and not even the most bizarre. Can you tell me about some of the other hoaxes you've uncovered?
We've had people who were faking cancer both online and in their real life, shaved their heads, told everyone around them that they had cancer. A lot of these people that make fake cancer battles online, they're exposed. They just kind of pack up shop and they move on to another blog or another support group or another Facebook group. It seems to be a real draw and a pull for them to do it again and again.
Now, there is actually a psychiatric condition that describes this very behavior long before the internet. It goes back to the middle part of the 19th century.
It's called Munchausen syndrome, and that's a condition in which somebody makes themselves physically sick for attention from doctors or from their loved ones. Munchausen by proxy is when somebody makes one of their loved ones sick, their children typically. And Munchausen by internet is when somebody goes online and poses as someone with an illness or someone who has a family member with an illness for attention and accolades from people who read their story.
So you go through many Facebook pages and other kinds of outreach. Are there any telltale signs for you that there is a hoax afoot?
Yeah. If you look at a page and it's just constant up and down drama, if they're not slipping into a coma one day, they're getting into a car accident the following day. There's always a baby that's in the neonatal intensive care unit. Just a ton of drama, like it's something that was on the WB or something. That to me would be a definite red flag.
Not only have you contacted these people and confronted them, you have since befriended a number of these people who were preying on the sympathies of outsiders. How did it happen that they became your friends?
I didn't expect it. I pretty much expected when I contacted them that they would be very angry with me. Along the lines of, you know, talking to them about what I had found out about them, I discovered that there were lots of things about them that I did like. I don't condone what they're doing, but at the same time, I can sort of understand why they're doing it. They're not in a good place. You know, they're not terrible people. They're not demons. I would never want to be judged by the worst thing that I did.
What's the worst thing that you've done?
I'm taking the fifth on that one.
I withdraw the question.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Is there anything that these people have in common?
We've had people that don't fit this mold, but typically it's a woman in their early 20s. To me, they sound like they're depressed. I almost feel sometimes like they're not comfortable with sort of sharing their own details, so they take on the persona of somebody that they admire.
Now, look, I don't want to sound like Oprah here, but as someone who had hitherto never really dug deep journalistically or otherwise into the secrets of the human heart, what have you learned from doing the blog WarriorEliHoax.com?
That people's stories are deeper than you would give them credit for. That even somebody that, when I'm researching them, to me seems like the worst person on the planet, that when I talk to them and kind of get to know them, they are not somebody that is without good qualities. I've also learned that the internet is not the nicest place for people when something like this comes out, that people are pretty quick to form a virtual lynch mob. And that, to me, is sort of disturbing, too.
Taryn, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Taryn Harper Wright is a former futures trader on the Chicago Board of Trade and blogs about online illness hoaxes at warriorelihoax.com. We spoke to her in September when she wrote her story for Fusion.
Coming up, how to sell sickness.
Liver was kind of just sitting back there while the other organs stepped to the plate and quite honestly have moved to the fore. We've got some catching up to do.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So far in this show, we've looked at how the language of health news reporting can often be misleading and fear-inducing, and about how that fear can be translated into a movement that mobilizes us to boycott chemicals we know little about because they sound scary, and how the internet can make a community around sickness, whether real or fake. In a marketplace so saturated with such bad health news, how does a charitable organization trying to raise awareness about its cause transcend the noise? In a piece we reported so many years ago that it is now a bona fide OTM classic, Bob considers the phenomenon of Awareness Week.
Edgar Allan Poe said it best. At midnight in the month of June, I stand beneath the mystic moon and contemplate the cruel unfairness of scleroderma unawareness. Okay, Poe didn't actually write that second part, but surely he would have if he weren't one of the majority of Americans woefully ill-informed on autoimmune disease, because awareness is a prerequisite for action, and June is indeed National Scleroderma Awareness Month. This is not to be confused with festivities surrounding other autoimmune nightmares, such as Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month, which is March, Lupus Awareness Month, which is October, Arthritis Awareness Month, May, or Psoriasis Awareness Month, also October. Or maybe Poe wouldn't have found a life-threatening disease of the connective tissue fitting to wax poetic about. No problem. June is also Myasthenia Gravis Awareness Month, National Aphasia Awareness Month, National Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, Fireworks Safety Month, and Host Month for Headache Awareness Week, Dystonia Awareness Week, and Helen Keller Deaf-Blind Awareness Week. Yes, this is a big country, and there are many scourges of which to be aware.
You know, there are some awareness weeks where I look at the disease and I think, I'm not even sure I've ever heard of that.
Jennifer Barrett is health editor for Newsweek magazine online.
It does prompt me to do a little research in it. So I think in some cases, it sort of puts it on your radar screen sometimes. It doesn't necessarily mean we're going to write about it right now, but it increases the awareness among the press.
Barrett articulates pretty much the best case scenario for the ever-growing awareness industry, whose foot soldiers must battle other news, other diseases, general indifference, and in the case of June, also Potty Training Awareness Week and National Accordion Awareness Week to get Disease X on the national radar. The steward of these observances is Captain Penelope Royal, Director of the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion at the Department of Health and Human Services.
The calendar has grown a lot since we started this in 1984 when we had 43 observances for the whole year.
This year, the number is 213, not counting the dozens of observances not officially sanctioned by HHS. The sheer number is problematic, awareness-wise, because there remain only 12 months or 52 weeks to vie for the nation's disease attention. For instance, Royal scanned her calendar and alighted on May.
How about Neurofibromatosis Month?
Do you happen to know what that condition is?
If you'll let me look it up, I can do that. Here we go. Neurofibromatoses are genetic disorders of the nervous system that primarily affect the development and growth of neural cell tissues.
Well, now I know about this disease. What am I supposed to do about it?
Well, what is next? Are you going to call the organization and find out more about it? Are you going to write a check out to help them develop cures? Are you going to walk around your neighborhood and try to raise money for the group? Are you going to go to your child's school and promote awareness there? Are you going to schedule a physical examination for yourself?
The answer to all of these questions, depressingly, is no. She also might have added, are you going to devote a story to it? But the month of June is slipping away, and we media elites are inundated with disease reporting opportunities. Richard Perez Pena is Metro Health reporter for the New York Times.
You working on anything about fireworks safety?
Actually, no. Fireworks are illegal in New York.
Scleroderma?
Scleroderma, no.
Aphasia?
Nope.
Myasthenia gravis? Dystonia?
No, no.
Headache?
No.
Cancer?
No. If there are awareness weeks or months about all of those, I'm unaware of them.
Because, he explains, while people like him may be generally familiar with various disease observances, they do not regard them as particularly relevant news pegs, partly because they are arbitrary and partly because no self-respecting journalist wants the news agenda dictated by outsiders, thank you very much. But did Perez Pena just a few weeks ago not do a big Metro Front story about hepatitis B smack in the middle of May's Hepatitis Month?
I have a horrible admission to make. I had no idea that there was a Hepatitis Awareness Month. It never even occurred to me.
But it occurred to the Centers for Disease Control, which timed the release of the very study he was quoting for Hepatitis Awareness Month. Because, like Big Tobacco and Big Oil, Big Liver understands message management, and it understands the challenge of breaking through public ignorance and indifference. In a recent survey, the American Liver Foundation discovered that half the population doesn't realize that hepatitis is liver disease, and 90% believe that the major cause of liver damage is not infection but alcohol abuse. Fred Thompson is president of the Liver Foundation.
The liver community has done a very bad job of focusing public attention on what liver disease actually is, exacerbated by the fact that there are over 100 different diseases. And many of those have their own little advocacy group. So there's a lot of fragmentation. And the liver community would be well served by bringing these various disparate factions together.
Easier for some organizations than for others. The Breast Cancer Pink Ribbon campaign has captured the imagination of millions. Likewise, Lance Armstrong's yellow wristbands. And colon cancer awareness got a boost when Katie Couric's husband died of the disease.
Liver was kind of just sitting back there while the other organs stepped to the plate and quite honestly have moved to the fore. We've got some catching up to do.
Do you lay awake at night wishing that Paris Hilton will get hepatitis B?
Having a celebrity or somebody like a Paris Hilton, and she happened to have liver disease and we could get her as a spokesperson, that would be probably very helpful. We all know what Katie Couric did for colon cancer. So we are hoping to find some celebrities.
God willing.
Yeah. God willing.
Relatively speaking, though, liver disease is still a marquee condition. Fred Thompson has it pretty easy next to Michael Beach, senior epidemiologist with the CDC's Division of Parasitic Diseases. Dr. Beach administers Recreational Water Illness Prevention Week.
This year, not as much pickup, but you know, in past years, we've managed to make it on the morning TV shows and that sort of thing on the national networks.
Remarkably, despite the native unsexiness of swimming pool hygiene, Beach's office has generated millions of web page views. But the fecal matter awareness message is a work in progress.
We regularly have conversations about how can we make the message more tantalizing and still be able to be tasteful and go through an approval process.
Can you give me an idea of what's been rejected?
No.
This brings us to Dan Bollinger, executive director of the International Coalition for Genital Integrity, that is, the anti-circumcision lobby.
How would you characterize the general state of American genital integrity awareness?
I think so many people are involved with the decision-making process. We're talking about millions a year, and certainly we need to have a million conversations about that.
Do you think there's a million conversations going on?
There are. Unfortunately, there tend to be rather short and curt, like, well, should we cut him or her? Well, I guess so. Okay.
Yet, despite the press releases and emails, the public service announcements, and even an itsy-bitsy little march on Washington, the 2006 Genital Integrity Awareness Week came and went with barely a peep about it in the American media. And that is the cruelest cut of all.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Alex Friedland and Dasha Litsasina, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Means.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. For all of us at On the Media, we wish you a happy and very healthy holiday season. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.